And we had so many orphan children. We had so many displaced women who had never worked for money before. So how do we train them? How do we support them?
Hey everyone, it's Nathan Long here, president of Saybrook University. Welcome to another episode of Saybrook Insights. Today we're featuring some incredible highlights from the past year, featuring our illustrious counseling program faculty. Whether it's Dr. Preston, Dr. Ramaswamy, Dr. Ferguson, or several others, you are in for a concentrated treat of excellent insights, wisdom, and more from these fabulous faculty members who walk the talk. All right, let's get to it with Counseling in Action. We all love higher ed. There are so many valuable things for all of our institutions across the United States. But I think where Saybrook kind of stands out and shines is that ability to allow us to show up as who we are and really valuing the individual's, you know, perspectives, what they bring to the table, as well as who they are just in general. You know, like that's an important aspect to it.
And I think when we can allow ourselves and then our students to do that, we're also really helping them develop the skills to let their clients come in and do that as well. So there's really that parallel process in being able to ask hard questions, to not understand things, to be having a difficult time and saying, I need some help. And so when we can do that as faculty and we can let our students do that, ultimately, we're helping the community be able to come into these conversations with our graduates.
You assess the landscape nationally right now relative to mental health for LGBTQIA populations. How would you kind of rate it and why, like, at this moment in time?
You know, it's really hard to put a number on it. And partly because I think there are pockets of inclusivity and acceptability. And depending on the city, sometimes even the state you're in. But I know there are huge chunks of middle America where it's still not safe, or in the South where it's still not completely safe. And I think if I were to, like, call to action anything, not necessarily rate, but focus in on, it's the as a nation, we still have a lot of work to do. Globally, we still have a ton of work to do. And I think that it's really interesting. I was having this conversation with a client recently. I also recognize that living in the New York City area or region is a unique place to be, right? Especially for queer folks. And so I was having a conversation or having a session with a client a couple of days ago, and he was talking about, like, going outside of that New York City bubble and going south to South Carolina and the ways in which he has to survey, like, his safety as a queer out Black man. You know, it's like, I'm looking, okay, I'm not seeing any other people of color. Okay, I'm not seeing any pride flags anywhere. So can I hold hands with my husband right now? And if I can't, then what does that mean? And how do I navigate these spaces and ensure that I get out safely? And so when you think of things like that, you think of a lot of folks who are in these metropolitan cities who go home for the holidays or spend time at home or just don't go home at all. And they spend years apart from their family because of that lack of safety. So as a whole, as a nation, we've made some progress. There's increased awareness. There's increased visibility in some states. There's some protection for the LGBTQIA community. But in some states, there are no protection as it pertains to the workplace and discrimination.
You do raise a fascinating point. Just last night, John Oliver came out with a fairly biting commentary on the mental health situation here in the United States. And one thing that it sounds like India is doing, right, is that they categorize the mental health issues that you talked about as a medical matter, not necessarily bifurcated as sort of over here as a mental health matter. It's all part of the, you know, one thing. And that was one point that he raised, whether it's coverage on insurance or access to care, that was a piece of it. What are your thoughts on that? I'm putting you on the spot a little bit here, but I'd be curious from your perspective.
I think there are certain diagnoses that respond very well to the medical model. You can't counsel someone into having a higher IQ. You can't counsel someone out of their diagnosis on an autism spectrum. So there are some diagnoses that do respond well and I'm not saying these are the only two or these two do to the medical model, but there's a whole slew of diagnoses. Diagnosis is pretty much the name we call symptoms. A lot of diagnoses that are very responsive to help. If you're having difficulty getting over a breakup, sure, you can take medication to help you if you're feeling really depressed, but at some point, you're going to have to develop coping skills to get beyond.
Maybe digging into the counseling program a little bit, what's your philosophy on the department and the type of teaching and preparation of therapists at a, you know, Saybrook counseling program should be doing and cultivating over, you know, the student's life in the program?
Yeah, it's a big question. I don't want to, I feel like I'm about to sound like a little bit of a broken record, but, which is kind of an odd phrase now, but anyway, I need something new. When I think about counselor training, so whether it's the master's training clinical mental health counselors or the PhD training future educators and supervisors, as a department whole, we all start with who's the community. Ultimately, who will people be serving and what are the needs of communities and families and children and other students? And then how do we help our students, especially in the master's program, because that's really where that identity as a clinician is starting to be formed. And it's kind of the birth of who they are as a practitioner. So we start with the community, and then what do our students need? And then it really, who are they? So even in our curriculum, like for example, a theories course or a research course, we're layering in, here's the textbook material, here's what we need for you to learn from this, and who are you in relation to these theories? Who are you in relationship to a research article you might be reading? And how will that then impact who you become as a practitioner and how that impacts the clients that sit with you? So we work from there. We talk a lot about training for this kind of the space between a clinical session. So if I'm working as a counselor and I have a client that's across from me, so much of the therapeutic process is happening in the space that's not necessarily what a client might be saying or might not be how a family or a couple are interacting. It's what else is going on around. And so we also have made a really, you know, specific decision, and a lot of the faculty that we've hired also just naturally tend to work kind of in that in-between space. And for me, I think that's what makes really strong clinicians and educators. You know, of course, we teach the skills. Of course, we teach the theories. Of course, we teach the ethics. But we teach those in relation to who each individual student is and who they will be when they're working.
In terms of mental health for LGBTQIA plus populations in general across the country, where do you see the gaps and also the positives, right? Because I know we've made some progress in certain key areas. Where do you see that, and where has there been effective inroads made, and what should we be doing more of, especially in this mental health crisis we're experiencing?
I think when I think about the mental health needs of the LGBTQIA community, I think of like the intentionality to create visibility and awareness. So I've seen it on multiple platforms where there's over conversations around the impacts of like childhood trauma and or like difficult coming out, like experiences with family members and community members. And I believe that that's great, and it's creating an awareness for us as a society and giving us like the tools or even like the insight that depending on how I react or how I engage with my queer family members and friends, this may have a lasting impact on them. And do I want to be responsible for that lasting impact? To some extent, you can't take all the responsibility, I'm sure, but to some extent, how do I want to play a role in that person's trauma? So there's like an accountability aspect there, and or responsibility for us as a society to engage with, again, marginalized communities in a way that's forwarding and progressive and supportive. going back to that golden rule, right? How do I want to treat others the way I want to be treated? On the flip side, I'll stay there actually. There's also, I've noticed, and I also recognize that I could be living in a bubble, but I noticed there's an increased interest and willingness to be culturally responsive and providing services to marginalized communities. I mean, I teach in the field experience course, so I've often, not often, but at times I've heard from students who are at like placement sites who are not super progressive. You know, they're not focusing in on, they're not doing what they can to work with the LGBTQ community and create safety there. There's so it depends on the region, depends on the state, depends on the city, and also depends on the leadership within that institution.
Mental health crisis, as we were in that conversation now, by some accounts, is the most acute it has been in the history, at least here in the United States, than ever before. I wonder from your perspective, as you're, you know, immersed in the literature and you're thinking about this with your students here at Saybrook and elsewhere in your professional community, from your perspective, how acute is the mental health crisis here in the United States? What do we do about it, especially with the huge need for therapists? You know, the supply of therapists is incredibly low. So I'd be curious what your thoughts are there.
You know, and I think the mental health needs in the United States is not the same for every community, for every age group. When you deal with losses, children who have lost parents, sometimes both, in COVID, somebody who has lost the breadwinner in the family, I think their need is immediate financial, sometimes adoption. Are we set up, like, you know, when you talk about the India crisis in 2021, we had this devastating 1-2 months where India was not even set up to support the kind of debts. And we had so many orphan children. We had so many displaced women who had never worked for money before. So how do we train them? How do we support them? They are not yet at a place where they have the privilege to develop a mental illness. Because you see, having a mental illness suggests that you're not as preoccupied with surviving. There is a poverty aspect there too. So the mental health need, when you're talking about socioeconomics, the lower socioeconomic status, with this poverty, they're looking at, how do I put food on the table? How do I feed my child? How do I make sure I get medical supplies for a special needs person or a disabled person? So their mental health crisis is a little more social setting, social work kind of setting. How do I connect them to the resources available? How do I provide access? How do I give them the support they need? How do I give them the encouragement that there will be a better tomorrow? So their mental health needs may or may not get qualified in a diagnostic code. And then you have people who are suicidal, who just feel like, this is too much. I cannot deal with this. The thought of dealing with a pandemic, the thought of not being able to go out of my house, the thought of not being able to lean on my support system. People who are used to group home settings, people who are used to having community support, whether it's the elderly, whether it is people with serious mental illnesses, they couldn't have that. They were naturally depleted on coping skills, and this just amplified their problem. So for them, some of that may have been temporary. Now that it's come back, they may be able to avail of the services again, but the fear, will this happen again? That sense of helplessness, that is a mental health need. Students who were socially isolated, who didn't have the benefit of developmentally interacting with other children, other peers, we've not even begun to understand in what way has it impacted. Yes, there was a benefit for some people, people who had social phobia, people who struggled to speak up in class. Now in an online mode, they didn't have to deal with that. But does that mean the need has kind of gone away? Maybe it's coming up. So those are the mental health needs that we will start seeing when we're no longer worried about health scares or dying or losing someone. When we feel that sense of, I can breathe, then those things will emerge.
So what about post-degree? Do, you know, if I'm in the program, do I get a job right away? Are there internships, practicums, you know, that are required as part of this? What does this all look like? I mean, am I going to be a student in counseling forever?
It will feel like it, maybe, but no. So the master's programs, these are big master's degrees. So they're 60 credits. The 60 credit is a requirement of our accrediting body and a requirement for almost every state is at 60 credit masters. So sometimes, you know, if students are in our program, then they know somebody that's in a 30 credit master's program. They can't figure out why they're not done yet. So it is. It's a 3-year program for the master's. Within the degree, there is a practicum and an internship in sort of the second half. So about semesters 4, 5, and 6. That is a place that requires, you know, in practicum about 1 day a week on a site and internship somewhere between 2 and 3 to get the hours in. So, again, it's another point of restructuring, commitments, family, other jobs, those kinds of things for that year. And then once students are done, there's a little variation state to state, but, as a general rule, once you complete your degree, you apply for, it's typically an associate's license. So the state approves you to start working, to be able to be providing clinical services. You can be paid for that. So you start a job, but you're working under a supervisor. And that supervisor's license. So they're responsible for your work as you're working towards your license. Most states, that's about 3,000 hours post-master's degree. So there's a practicum and internship pre-degree, and then there's around 3,000 hours post-degree. But people can get paid. It's a job. There's supervision, but they can start working.
You mentioned, you know, that your work is also with the BIPOC population, and you've been doing some work in you know, around mood disorder, psychosocial stressors. Can you talk a little bit? Because I think some of that dovetails into your research, if I'm not mistaken, as well.
Absolutely. And I think, so in my clinical training, post my master's degree, work in the field, I've worked in various spaces. So I've worked in an inpatient crisis unit, which is very interesting and exciting. I've worked in outpatient. I've done like in-home therapy where I've gone into families who are have open like ACS or child protective services cases, and this is just one form of remediation and support. And so I've been in the home, outpatient, and in inpatient units. And so what I've really collected from those various experiences are, it is important to note that BIPOC community may show up or may experience depression and anxiety or other mood disorders in ways that aren't in alignment with the clinical diagnosis or showing up in the textbooks, right? And I think there's that cultural piece. And for example, oftentimes Black and Brown folks have this, have been conditioned, because I do think a part of it is learned, a part of it is survival, that they have to work through it. So you may have a client who is experiencing symptoms, but know that, you know, my family is dependent on me, so I can't like give in to that. I got to power through and do this while not addressing like the challenges they may have. You may have a client who's resistant to coming into counseling, and there's very overt symptoms they're experiencing, but they don't understand why they're there, because they don't believe that this is going to help them at all. Like, they don't believe talk therapy is going to do anything, but they're either being mandated or being forced or like strongly encouraged to do it. So I think these are just a couple examples as to how like the cultural piece may show up in the room.
What are your thoughts around kind of the global situation? I know that's a lot to handle in like a couple minutes.
I think, you know, last year I was very involved with the Indian infrastructure there, because they're not set up to deal with this. So I was very actively involved in how do we create existing hotspots, convert them into mental health centers. So what we did was, the Indian community by nature is connected to either the place of worship, the spiritual center, or their school centers. So there's a lot of investment and training overnight using the rapid model that Hopkins put out. How do we train people who are used to working others in dealing with the COVID crisis?
And what about job placement and staying connected with alumni after graduation? You know, how do you all manage that?
A lot of the job placement stuff, honestly, it tends to happen within individual networks connected with their internship sites. So once students are in that field placement, they're getting to know clinicians and agencies through state organizations and affiliations. Because we're so spread out, faculty, we have some contacts in states, but that tends, it happens to, happens a bit organic. We have a good percentage of our students who are hired at their sites, which has been lovely to see. And then as far as alumni connection, you know, we try to stay connected. Our graduates email us updates and how they're doing. I think that's an area we can continue to improve, again, just by virtue of being so spread out. But people come in and they talk about having among their peers, like colleagues and friends, kind of for the long run. So by the time people are out, they don't really need us much anymore. They've got their group, they've got their support, they've got each other. And so then they're just checking in with updates and the fun stuff.
And what a great testament to the counseling program that they're already landing those jobs or positions or future positions through their internships. I mean, ideally, that's what you want to see happen. I know that isn't always the case.
So,
what's one or two things that you would advise a student who's considering applying to the counseling program?
So a couple of things that come to mind is time management, the importance of figuring out your life, because your life doesn't stop because you're in school, right? So figuring out, setting yourself up in a way where you get to be in school, but you also get to live, because that can also reduce burnout. The other thing I think about is this program is going to challenge you. It's going to, if you allow it, if you are open to it, it'll make you a better person and a great clinician.
And it's going to be a lot of work.
Whether
it was young people or retired folks who were out there making, you know, inroads in terms of that support. Is that infrastructure or model ubiquitous here in the United States? Could there be more of that, like what's happening in India currently? I just think that seems like it could have some real benefits, especially as we look at the long road ahead.
I think there is a lot of interest in using those models for professionals, better professionals to go into the community to offer help. But I think the United States has a lot of credentialing, licensing regulations that may actually interfere with our ability to get help to those communities that need it. And it doesn't mean it's not possible. It just means we have to be creative and find a way to do that. And also, when you're talking about a situational crisis, we are able to do a whole lot of things. For instance, the regulations were opened up. So we were able to support people in India, even though we're not in the country.
I have, you know, the rapid fire.
Oh, no.
All right, so I'm going to bring it on here. The two main questions. You know, my questions are always multi-questions.
Right.
So what does the term humanistic mean to you? Specifically, how does it show up in counseling?
To me, it means honoring the person that's in the room with me or group of people that are in the room with me, no matter how they're coming in and what they're experiencing and what their past has been, what their present is. It's just letting us be two human beings or eight human beings if I'm running a group. And letting the rest of that go and letting us all be together in that moment towards healing.
That was pretty impressive there, Dr. Preston.
Thank you.
I like that. All right.
It's easy because it's who we are as a department. Yep. So didn't feel like a trick one.
It's a natural fit for Saybrook, which is the humanistic focus institution. What does the term humanistic mean to you?
So humanistic means to me, and I think I hinted at this earlier, because it's an embodiment. It's like, how do we share and engage with people in a way where we're equal? It's really at its core a heart-to-heart connection. It's like being able to empower people to be their authentic selves while also modeling what it looks like to be your authentic self in all spaces or most spaces.
You've written about reclaiming multicultural healing practices as world traditions that add value to Western counseling theories. And I think especially for the counselors out there and our fellow psychotherapists and social workers, this is interesting ground to cover. What does this mean ultimately? And why is this so important from your perspective? I think you've alluded to some of this already, but there's more depth there, I know. So love to hear your perspective.
I think a musician who sings the device of their voice. For a counselor, their device is their personhood. It's not what they do. It's who they are that is manifest in their interactions. It's not what you do, but who you are. So having said that, I think as I've stayed in the counseling profession, I have appreciated the clarity and the structure afforded by younger Western theories as to why is there psychopathology, why is there dysfunction, and what can you do about it, what helps. And I think there's value in it. But I also come from ancient wisdom traditions that have healed themselves well before counseling was even a thing. And what about those communities? Is that also going to your larger question you had asked me earlier, that mental health services are something that the Western world is making up? Maybe in the way it is construed. Because you see, preventive practices are remedial practices in many of these traditions. And there's a whole lot of wisdom, whether it is all of us, no matter how different we are, live in a human body. Some of us with more levels of ability, and while others don't. We have a brain that to certain levels of abilities and disabilities function. And we are social emotional creatures. Now, each one of that is limited by disabilities and abilities, I understand, and this culture. But there is a way to keep that body functioning well. There is a way to keep that mind engaged. And there is a way to keep our spirit, if you will. I'm talking about the human spirit and not the Holy Spirit. To keep our human spirit vibrant. And that's where these wisdom traditions come in. We have dancing, we have music, we have yoga, we have meditation, we have spirituality. We have so many kinds of ancient traditions that were not because you had a mental illness or a diagnosis, but they figured out through practice, you do it, things make a whole lot of better sense. You're able to navigate life better. You don't suffer as much because, you see, that was their preoccupation. How do we suffer less?
Boy, I hope you learned a lot today from our counseling folks. If you want to see the YouTube version, please visit our Saybrook YouTube page. We have plenty of videos of the Saybrook Insights podcast there. And if you'd like to support the podcast, go to Apple iTunes, leave that 5-star rating and review, and subscribe so you can get episodes as they come out. If you're on Spotify, leave that 5-star rating and make sure to follow us. And of course, you can always subscribe to us on most other major podcast platforms, including Amazon, Google, Stitcher, Pandora, and others. Remember to check our show notes for information on today's guest, including links to websites, books, and the like. And for more about our university, go to www.saybrook.edu. Click on Areas of Study at the top of the page and locate the program of your choice to learn more. Or simply Google Saybrook University. That's it for today, folks. Thanks so much for joining us, and tune in next week.